Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. She was 47 inches tall, weighed maybe 110 pounds, lived 4.4 million years ago, and left behind a fossilized skeleton that is electrifying the world of science with its new window into human evolution. Ardi, Ardipithecus ramidus, was found in the sun-baked Afar Triangle of Ethiopia 4.4 million years ago. That was forest, and she apparently stood upright and walked, sort of like you and me. This hour, On Point, Ardi and Humankind. Joining me now from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Owen Lovejoy, a lead analyst on the Ardi Project. He's professor of biological anthropology at Kent State University. His team spent 15 years excavating and analyzing Ardipithecus ramidus, the 4.4 million-year-old female skeleton found in Ethiopia. The researchers have just made a big splash with their announcement of their findings. They say it rejiggers our understanding of human evolution. Dr. Lovejoy, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Why so much hubbub? We know it's huge, but you're the scientist. Explain to us, why is everyone jumping up and down about this discovery, Dr. Lovejoy?
Well, it's because it reveals a vast new quantity of knowledge about what the common ancestor of the living chimpanzee and humans look like. Lucy, at 3.2 million, had some pretty advanced adaptations. And as a consequence, there was a tendency to try to mold her into a kind of missing link between the living chimpanzee and humans. But in reality, what we found out with the recovery of Ardipithecus is that the last common ancestor of chimpanzees and humans was quite different than anyone anticipated.
Now, Ardipithecus itself is not that ancestor, if I understand this correctly, but a sort of a signpost toward that even older common ancestor. Is that right?
That is correct. Ardi, as we call her for short, is in fact a human ancestor, and pretty well along the way toward what would be her descendant, which is Lucy, and quite a ways from, in time, the last common ancestor, which would have been considerably more primitive than even Ardi was.
So in evolutionary terms, I'm looking at an image, and there were so many tiny, tiny pieces of this skeleton put together to the extent that people have been able to create an image. Are you persuaded by this image that I'm looking at? It's everywhere now, this kind of rather human-looking, except for the opposable big toe on the foot, rather human-looking sort of kind of hairy, bearded female. Did you sign off on this one, Owen Lovejoy?
Yes, I did. Actually, that is an image you're probably looking at from Jay Maternus, who is a highly qualified reconstructive artist who has done years and years of dissection work on primates and humans and has done a painstaking reconstruction from the skull through the musculature into the flesh. Some of the things are obviously speculative. We don't know things like the actual distribution of hair in the face. We don't know skin color, although we can make good educated judgments about that kind of thing, given the environment. But largely, that's a pretty accurate image of what Ardi would have looked like.
Listeners can see it at our website, onpointradio.org, but this is strikingly more kind of human in its dimensions than the old traditional drawings we've all seen of kind of a ape or chimp, you know, sort of slowly standing up and becoming the erect Homo sapien, Dr. Lovejoy.
Yes, that one of the reasons is because Ardipithecus tells us that the living chimpanzee and the living gorilla, which is very close, chimpanzees and gorillas and humans almost triverged, if you will, from a common ancestor. We share a little bit more commonality in DNA with the chimpanzee than we do with the gorilla, but all three of these clades or phyletic lines pretty much diverged at about the same time we think, between 7 and 10 million years ago.
So what we see here is less like the living chimp than some of our older images of these of ancient, more than ancient ancestors, I guess.
Very much so, because Lucy was so advanced, we really didn't have any good fossil evidence as to what the last common ancestor actually looked like. So people tended to try to morph, if you will, Lucy and the living chimpanzee into a common ancestor. Now that we have something that's much closer in both morphology and time to the actual last common ancestor, we have some significant surprises. And a lot of these involve the fact that chimpanzees and gorillas have evolved on their own a great deal since that ancestor.
So they don't look now like they looked then. Neither does the terrain where this fossil skeleton was found. Can you describe a bit for us the Afar Triangle in Ethiopia, what it looks like now, where all this digging and retrieving went on, and what it might have looked like from the evidence 4.4 million years ago?
Yes, today it's virtually desertic. There's almost no vegetation. It's quite sparse, and of course that's one of the great advantages. It allows human origin specialists to search for fossil remains because there's no vegetation in the area that obscures those remains when they're brought to the surface by erosion. 4.4 million years ago, the area would have been much higher in altitude. It would have been far less dry. What we can tell from the plants and small mammals and large mammals, essentially, that it's a woodland environment. I wouldn't call it a forest,
okay. But
it's woodland with about 50 to 60% tree cover, few areas of grass in between, but mostly areas of browsing and that kind of thing.
Now, this is important in part because kind of mainstream understanding had been that our ancestors stood up on the savanna, I don't know, perhaps to look over tall grass. The fact that this is woodland and the structure of the bone structure and pelvic structure, which you've studied in particular, suggests something else perhaps, that we didn't begin to stand up in the savanna?
Oh, yes, that's now completely disproven by Ardipithecus and by the logic and structure of the skeleton that we're looking at. Looking over tall grass is really a posture, not a locomotion.
Mm-hmm.
And those are very different. Chimpanzees and gorillas frequently adopt a bipedal posture, even though they themselves are not very good bipeds in terms of locomotion. And there's a big difference between choosing an habitual way of getting around in the world and simply occasionally looking over grass or reaching for fruit or these kinds of things, which can be done quite simply without transforming your skeleton. But what we see in hominids from the very beginning, now represented by Ardipithecus, although there must have been several million years of evolution before Ardipithecus, in the direction of walking erect, what we find is that they've chosen this particular form of locomotion as their habitual way of getting around on the ground, despite the fact that there are many disadvantages to upright walking.
And also in spite of the fact that one of the really notable features here is this opposable big toe, which must have let them be very agile when climbing in trees.
That's one of the really striking things about Ardi that we did not have when we looked at the skeleton of Lucy. Lucy is about 3.2 million years old, and yet there are some footprints from Laetoli in Tanzania that are about 3.6 to 3.7 million years old. And these are highly accurate impressions of the bottom of the foot of our ancestors, and they tell us that at that age we already had what is called the longitudinal arch. And that arch, in order to exist, had to have the great toe, or what you call the big toe, in line with the other digits.
And you, by longitudinal arch, you just mean the arch of the, what we now think of the arch of the human foot.
That's right, yes. The space essentially between the heel and what we call the ball of the foot.
I don't know if you can answer a why question here, but why would a creature so good at climbing have been inclined to upright walking when they could just climb like crazy?
That's a very interesting question, and I think it's a behavioral issue rather than a mechanical one. I think that the evidence indicates that upright walking became part of their reproductive strategy.
Mating, like showing off?
No, probably to carry things. And the thing that's most important in terms of moving around for an animal of this level of evolution, i.e. that's one not evolved with technology and stone tools and the like, the most important thing you can carry are either your offspring or food. The problem with becoming a biped is that for a chimpanzee and a gorilla, they really don't need to carry their offspring because they're infants and small adults or small children can hang on to their parents because they have the grasping toe.
Dr. Lovejoy, you were talking about the emergence of upright walking as part of a reproductive strategy. Sew those pieces together. Exactly why? How?
Well, it's pretty complicated. One of the things that we haven't talked about thus far is teeth. And two of the things that Artie shows us that are very striking are that, first of all, she doesn't have teeth like her descendant Lucy. Her chewing teeth are much more generalized, and they indicate that she's much more of a forest floor omnivore than Lucy, who lived more on the savanna, as you mentioned earlier. But the other thing is that the canine in the males of this species is vastly reduced, so much so that it no longer serves the same function as it does in all other higher primates.
They don't have those big, long, canine, kind of fierce-looking teeth in what we found from Artie?
Yes. The canine in a chimpanzee or a gorilla or any form of old-world monkey in the male is extremely large. When it closes down, when you shut your mouth and closes down, the top canine hones against the lower canine to keep it sharp. So these are, in fact, weapons and elements of threat that males can use against other males, either to defend territory or for access to females. And yet in Artie's species, the canine in the male has completely gone away in terms of its projection above the rest of the teeth, and it's therefore no longer serves as a weapon or as a threatening element that the male could use against other males. This implies that females, in the evolutionary sense, are choosing males which are not aggressive.
Because so they're not fighting with their teeth over the female. They don't have those teeth, you say.
That's right. The way a female primate usually gains genetic success is to have her genes spread in successive generations by aggressive males that will interbreed with as many females as possible. So it is a natural thing for a female primate to choose a male with large canines and one who has an aggressive behavioral element.
Now, this is where you're getting very analytical here. Not everybody in academia will agree with this, but you're describing a kind of monogamy emerging here in the evidence of the Artie fossils, evidence of monogamous relationships. I mean, I'm reading here others saying this isn't persuasive. Some people just don't go with it, but that's what you're finding in this skeleton, and it's evidence, Dr. Lovejoy.
That's correct. One has to explain why the canine teeth of the species in the males were essentially made smaller and smaller until they became ineffective as elements of aggression. That implies that females are choosing such males as their preferred mates. Now, when we only had Lucy, her cheek teeth or her chewing teeth were so large that many people made the argument that the canine reduced in response to the enlargement of the cheek teeth. In other words, to make it simple, so that the cheek teeth would have more room in the mouth, the canine reduced in size and somehow got replaced in terms of aggression with the use of weapons or something like that. Mm. But we're dealing now with a species that's not as bipedal as Lucy and whose cheek teeth are quite normal in terms of their size and enamel thickness and these other characters. So that's no longer an effective explanation of why the canines reduced in size in early hominids and in association with upright walking.
Now, with this interpretation, we're getting into a zone of some academic dispute, and we'll hear some of that in a minute. Owen Lovejoy, I want to turn to our listeners for a moment, if I may. Jesse in Plattsville, Connecticut. Jesse, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a quick question and a comment real quick. I was just curious, with such a vast span of time, how, in layman's terms, how are you able to tell whether it's 3 million years or 4 million years? And my comment is, I find it really actually special to live in this time, considering how much the human race has accomplished in, like, the last 1,000 years, where over a whole 4 million, 10 million years before, it almost seems like the human race didn't accomplish very much in comparison to how much we have in this period.
Jesse, let me put it to the biological anthropologist, Owen Lovejoy. First of all, how do you date this? And what do you make of Jesse's observation about accomplishment?
I want to start with Jesse's observation of accomplishment first, because it's really, really a special observation on his part. One of the interesting things about human evolution is that we began to use tools about 2.6 million years ago, that is, stone tools. But those stone tools didn't change for over a million years. And then after that, there was ushered in a period of what we call Acheulean hand axes. And these were, again, primitive lithic tools, but they didn't change for about 500 to 600,000 years. And the point I'm making in response to Jesse's comment is that technology evolves logarithmically, because everything that one generation has includes everything that all other previous generations were able to accomplish. So if you look at the history of technology, it's been accelerating at a fantastic clip, especially over the last 500 years. For example, you couldn't do nuclear physics unless you could do calculus.
And now this morning we have the Nobel Prize announcements with fiber optics and digital communications, whereas we spent a million years with those first stone tools back when.
That's right.
What about the dating of this?
Okay. There are now a vast variety of techniques that one can use to age fossils like this, especially in East Africa. These are usually based on radiometric assessment of volcanic tufts. For example, when a volcano erupts, it produces a fingerprint of various elements that are left in the ash that is deposited above or below where we find a fossil. And there are various radiometric methods assessing half-life of elements that can be used to determine just how long that tuff has been there. So if the tuff lies above the fossil remains, it's older than the tuff, or if the tuff lies below, we know the fossil is younger.
So you're dating by the layers of earth, in this case volcanic remains above and below Artie's skeleton.
That's right.
Huh. Let me get one more call here from Scott in Belmont, Massachusetts. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to just maybe inject some cautionary note into the discussion, just because although I'm not a scientist, I've taken some advanced coursework at Brandeis and Harvard regarding evolutionary science.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we've found the skeleton, and I think it's thrilling to find something, a skeleton, just as it would be for a dinosaur, it's very difficult scientifically without DNA evidence to find, make a conclusion about common ancestry. And I'd just like to talk about maybe an analogy, which is in plant biology, scientists used to look at the physical structures of plants to try to find a common ancestor of a plant.
Mm-hmm.
But when DNA science was put into the study, people scientists realized that plants that looked totally different were actually much more related. So I guess we found one skeleton and we can examine the teeth, but I was wondering if your guests could comment on some of the limitations that are involved.
Let's pick it up. Thank you very much, Scott. Owen Lovejoy, can we really say conclusively that this is a human ancestor? And what about DNA? Does it come into play at all here? Is there no DNA in a fossilized skeleton?
No, there's no protein or DNA preserved in specimens this old.
Mm-hmm.
But our DNA evidence comes from comparison of the DNA of modern living chimpanzees and modern living humans, which is remarkably similar. And we can, in fact, compare the level of genetic relationship amongst all the primates now by not only looking at individual genes and doing things called like DNA-DNA hybridization, but since we now have a full copy of the chimpanzee genome, we can make fairly exacting comparisons of the human genetic structure and that of chimpanzees.
But how does that prove that Ardi is in our line of ascent, descent, whatever you want to call it?
Well, you are correct. We cannot use DNA evidence in that sense, but we have to base that assessment on morphology. But the morphology of Ardi is in many ways strikingly similar to even living humans.
Morphology, you mean the actual shape of the creature?
That's correct. For example, in the hand skeleton, there are a number of features that Ardi preserves that we did not have from Lucy, which shows that, in fact, the chimpanzee hand has evolved more from the common ancestral state than has the human hand. In a number of ways, the modern living human hand is primitive in the sense that it still retains some of the features that we find in Ardipithecus.
But our caller, Scott, says, you know, plants can look similar and be unrelated or dissimilar and be genetically related.
True, but you have to triangulate your evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And triangulation of the evidence from the living chimpanzee, humans, and our DNA relationships and the structure of the skeleton can provide that kind of evidence. Now, what Scott will recognize is that the more detailed a similarity that we can find between two forms, the more likely does that similarity reflect a true genetic one. And there are many detailed features of the Ardipithecus skeleton that are remarkably similar to their what we call homologs in living humans. There's even a small sesamoid bone in the foot called the os peroneum, which is present in Ardi and present in modern humans, but absent in apes. And that tells us that Ardipithecus, even though it's an advanced primate, is much more hominid or human-like than we thought when we simply looked at Lucy. Of course, the other thing about the shape of the skeletons that we're talking about is that the human pelvis is extremely specialized for upright walking. And again, the pelvis of both Ardi and Lucy show these primary adaptations to upright walking that no other primate has.
I want to welcome to our conversation now from George Washington University, Bernard Wood. He's professor of human origins and human evolutionary anatomy there, senior scientist at the National Museum of Natural History and the Smithsonian Institution. Bernard Wood, thanks very much for joining us today from Washington.
Hi, it's my pleasure.
So Owen Lovejoy is with us. He's done a lot of work on Ardi. He's made a big investment in this. You've no doubt read the enormous number of papers that came out last week around this, and you hear Owen Lovejoy describing Artie, today, as someone who's not invested in it in the same way, how are you looking at the revelations that we're seeing and hearing about over the last week, Professor Wood?
Well, the first thing to say is, if I could say hello to Owen, who I've known for a long time.
Okay. Hi, Werner.
Hi. I don't know, I didn't catch the beginning of the conversation because I was actually teaching a class. But it's very difficult to overemphasize the enormous amount of work that went into recovering this material. And for most of us, it's
mind-boggling.
A minor miracle that it was found in the first place, and a minor miracle that everybody had enough that they were willing to put so much effort into recovering this material from the field. And obviously Owen and his group have done a lot of work to analyze it. So I'm not, you know, I'm here, you know, I'm here to praise Caesar in that respect.
Okay.
I guess my thoughts about it, and you can imagine that it's not possible to assimilate all the details that mm-hmm. these guys have put in all the papers in a relatively short amount of time. But my main thought really harks back to the guy who phoned just now, Scott, mm-hmm. and that is it concerns something called homoplasy, which is really what he alluded to. It's an impenetrable term, but let me give you an example. You learn to recognize motor cars because they have distinctive radiator grills.
Mm-hmm.
If another car manufacturer suddenly started to manufacture a radiator grill that looked remarkably like one of the existing ones, you wouldn't be so good at recognizing cars because you would mm-hmm. there would be a confusion because mm-hmm. these two very similar radiator grills, they actually have very different origins. They come from two different car companies.
Are you suggesting Artie's not our ancestor with that?
Well, I'm suggesting that we know, and I know Owen thinks that some of this work is a bit too sort of generalized, but we know in general terms that there is about one-third of all morphology is probably prone to homoplasy. In other words, one-third of morphology is telling you what is about your phylogenetic history. It's not a good clue to phylogenetic history. And I'm just concerned that although I think, and if I was in Owen's situation, I would also emphasize the similarities of Ardi to later hominins. There are also differences. And by assuming that it's a hominin, you have to incur a whole lot of homoplasy elsewhere on the tree of life in relation to our close living ancestors. And I just think it might be, it might have been profitable to spend a little longer in the analysis to actually think about Ardi not being a human ancestor.
Bernard Wood, hold that thought if you would. Owen Lovejoy, we'll be right back with more on Ardipithecus ramidus. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we've just been hearing an interesting sort of colloquy of two professionals in the field beginning to maybe debate a bit about the origins and connections here with Bernard Wood saying, Owen Lovejoy, maybe we're assuming it's hominin related to humans a little too quickly, that it might have been good to spend more time imagining it as not a human ancestor. What do you say to that, Dr. Lovejoy?
Well, we spent a great deal of time presuming that its primary similarity was with living chimpanzees and gorillas, which was the primary assumption that has been around ever since Darwin, because we did not have fossil evidence to demonstrate the what is essentially what Bernard has raised, the issue of homoplasy in chimpanzees and gorillas. And what we've discovered by looking at Ardi is that much of the similarities that we see in the locomotor skeleton of chimpanzees and gorillas are in fact likely to be homoplasies. And when we compare these details of the Ardi skeleton with chimpanzees and humans, we find that Ardi is human-like, not chimpanzee-like.
Homoplasia, again, this is a kind of a visual similarity. Maybe that's too great a simplification, but is that the gist of it?
Well, it's a academic term that means parallel evolution. It means that two living clades or phyletic lines have acquired the same morphology independently of one another, so that the genetic basis of that morphology may not be the same.
Bernard Wood, just to ask it one more time, then, are you raising doubts even now that this is, in fact, a human ancestor?
Well, I think, there is no doubt that this is an important animal. If we assume that most of the homoplasia exists outside of our twig of the tree of life, then it's probably a reasonable hypothesis to assume that this is one of our ancestors. But if we assume that homoplasia is equally likely to be within our twig of the tree of life as it is outside our twig of the tree of life, then I think it's intriguing to think of this animal as being maybe closely related to chimps, bonobos, and modern humans, but not a human ancestor. That is a bit of a leap, but in some ways it's more parsimonious than assuming it is a human ancestor. And then you have to assume that there's a lot of homoplasia somewhere else in the tree of life. It's a bit like, a NIMBY argument. I like homoplasia, but I don't want it in my backyard.
I'm sure some people are still stumbling on this term homoplasia, by which you mean... what? Can you say all that without using the word homoplasia?
Yeah. Shared morphology, which is not inherited from a recent ancestor.
And morphology, again, by that you mean a visual similarity or a structural.
Similarities, the things that look similar, but we did not inherit them from our most recent common ancestor. Therefore, those things are not reliable witnesses of our evolutionary history in terms of our phylogeny.
Owen Lovejoy, do you assume that in a year or 5 years or 10, everyone will agree that this is a human ancestor? Or is this likely to go on forever in academia or for a long time, this question?
Well, I think Bernard hasn't had a chance to obviously go through the 300 or so pages that we put into Science. But the striking thing about Artie, when we compare it to, again, Lucy, to modern humans, and to more ancient apes like Proconsul, is that humans appear in certain ways to have evolved a lot less than have chimpanzees and gorillas. Again, I raise the hand as an example. The elements of the central part of our hands appear to have remained unchanged for... millions of years. And so the issue of homoplasia or parallel evolution isn't really involved here, because we're talking about morphologies that have not changed rather than have changed.
Let's get a call from Alan in Roanoke, Virginia. Alan, you're on the air.
Yes. Thanks for taking the call. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Listen, actually, I'm interested in the conversation, but I'm wondering, curiously, why does it seem like the gender of all these species that they are locating that may be part of our evolutionary tree all seem to be female, and if in fact they do discover male skeletons?
Why so many people? Why Lucy and Artie showing up? Is that just chance, Owen Lovejoy, or something else? Why female skeletal remains?
Oh, it's chance. I mean, when you consider what we have, which is two skeletons, it's the chances are about the same as flipping a coin twice and having it come down heads both times. I mean, it's one out of four probability that if you have two skeletons, they'll both be female. We have the remains of a number of male individuals from Artie species, and we have a large number of male individuals from Lucy species. It just so happens that we don't have complete skeletons of male individuals, because we only have two complete skeletons, one from each species.
Bernard Wood, Owen Lovejoy has looked at what's been found here, seen that the remains of male shell specimens do not have large, sharp canine teeth. And from that, taken away, that perhaps they didn't have the same competition in mating, the kind of fierce chimpanzee or ape-like competition, that there may even have been monogamous relationships going on 4.4 million years ago. How does that strike your ear?
Well, it strikes me as being interesting, but it's developing hypotheses that are rest on a previous hypothesis and then on a previous hypothesis. It's an interesting hypothesis that Owen has been suggesting for some time. I'm not sure that the evidence is able to withstand a lot of scrutiny in terms of examining it. You know, I think it's one of the things that's out there. I don't think it's the only explanation for the small canines. The small canines do allow you to chew in a slightly different way, and even though the teeth of Ardi are reasonably generalized, they may have already been we need to look at the microware. They may have already been beginning to chew like the later hominins. It's I think the basic difference between Owen's and my philosophy is that I think, and they're both, I would hope that Owen would think that they're both reasonable ways of coming at this. One is that the null hypothesis is that if you find something at the right time and the right place, then it's an ancestor. The other is the hypothesis that if you look elsewhere on the tree of life, there are many more branches that are not ancestral than there are ancestors. And so, therefore, another null hypothesis would be that if you find a fossil in the right place at the right time, then it's not an ancestor until you can prove it. There is a bit of history. It's exactly half a century since Lewis Leakey announced the discovery of Zingiantropus boisei.
Mm-hmm.
Which was an interesting creature, which we think is more closely related to us than the chimps and the bonobos. And because it was the only creature found at Olduvai where he had found stone tools, he said it was the stone tool maker and it was almost certainly our ancestor. Now, a few years later, they found some more fossils of a different creature, which they called Homo habilis. And this was probably a more likely ancestor. So poor old Zingiantropus boisei had a very short career as being our ancestor and being a stone toolmaker. I'm not saying that this is the same with Ardipithecus, but all I'm saying is that it's a cautionary tale. And just because something is found in the right place at the right time, it doesn't necessarily mean it's our ancestor.
I'll ask Owen Lovejoy to respond to that, but let me ask you first. For lay people listening to this conversation, how do you judge the significance of the difference? Is it simply, and this is no small thing, but simply a matter of academic accuracy, Bernard Wood, or does it change the way we understand ourselves, whether we're, related to, descended from this creature or that?
I think it's no matter how much fossil evidence you have, it's going to be extremely difficult to be absolutely certain that something at 4.4 million years ago is ancestral. And to me, it doesn't make a lot of difference. These are interesting creatures. Mm-hmm. They were living in different times than us. They have no living analogy. I agree with Owen about that completely. There is no living animal. There is no living animal that sort of captures the biology of these people, of these extinct creatures. And that's one of the challenges of paleontology. It's to try and work out what an animal was doing when you have no living animal that you can go and watch as a completely accurate model. And that's what makes it, that's what makes paleoanthropology an intriguing thing to be interested in.
Owen Lovejoy, how do you? I mean, first there's the question of how and when we absolutely know, and then the question of what it matters to absolutely know.
Well, absolute knowledge is something that we scientists.
Okay, yes, wrong word, but you can take my gist.
Yes. I agree with Bernard that until we get a much more complete fossil record, we're not going to have complete agreement amongst those who study these skeletons as to their various phyletic relationships. I'll give you an example. In our paper, we point out that we don't know if Artie is, in fact, a lineal ancestor of Lucy, or, in fact, if Lucy is a lineal ancestor of Homo erectus, which follows it. But that's not the major impact of Artie in terms of our knowledge. What Artie tells us that even if it's an offshoot, even if it's a side branch of human evolution, it reveals things about the age and structure of the various anatomical components of humans and chimpanzees that we never knew before. And it tells us about some of the unique features of hominids and how old they are. For example, I'll raise the issue of a mouthful of anatomy, which is something called the anterior inferior iliac spine, which is a feature. It's a growth center in the pelvis that only humans, Lucy and Artie, have. No other primate has this growth center. So this is one of those anatomical areas where homoplasy can largely be ruled out because the level of similarity is so exact.
We're stretching 4.4 million years back, and it is endlessly fascinating. Let's get a call from Julie in Williamstown, Vermont. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. I was wondering if I read that she was found in a forest environment, and I was wondering whether there was evidence for it being a wet or a dry environment, or if it could have been like a rainforest or tropical flooded area. Because I've read about the, and it seems to make a lot of sense to me, the possibility that humans evolved upright features and hairlessness, omnivorous teeth, loss of heat seasons, because they were evolving in a wet environment and going back to some of the neonatal features the way other mammals who've gone back to water environments.
Interesting, Julie. Let us pick it up. A woodland environment, Owen Lovejoy says, but what about wetland, Dr. Lovejoy?
No. The environment, when we say woodland here, we do not mean tropical forest. And one of the things that is actually absent from Artie's environment are things called lake margins, which we find later on in the human fossil record, but well after the evolution of upright walking. So, in fact, based on Artie, upright walking evolved in a region where there was essentially no standing water.
But a lot drier than it is now. Bernard Wood, our time begins to grow short. As you look at Artie, as the whole world does in the weeks and years ahead, what are you going to be looking most closely at, Dr. Wood, to figure out, you know, what you make of the significance of this find?
See, I think the significance will emerge when a larger group of people look at the evidence in as much detail and as conscientiously as Owen and his colleagues have done. I mean, there's an interesting quote that I saw the other day that at least one other person is probably smarter about your data than you are, and I forget where I saw that. So I think, you know, the more people that have access to this material, the more people who think about it, the more people who bring their experience to bear on it, the better informed that we will be. But it's been a pleasure to be on your show because it's given me a chance to say in person to at least one of the members of the team to convey my heartiest congratulations to them, because this has been a really great effort.
A tremendous piece of work by every account. Owen Lovejoy, this is kind of a once-in-a-century find. You can't expect to find another Artie anytime soon.
No, although I will say if there's one out there, Tim White will find it.
Your colleague out in the blazing sun of Ethiopia. Wow. Well, it's been wonderfully insightful to have both of you with us, and we're grateful to you. I should say at our website, onpointradio.org, we have links to the full package in Science Magazine, laying out lots of detail here. I think our listeners would enjoy that. Bernard Wood at George Washington University, we're grateful to you for coming on with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
And Owen Lovejoy, for your years of work on ARDI, thank you very much, and thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.